As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Late night, midnight on the interstate, and I didn't feel so great. Till I saw the city.
Welcome back to Straight from the Source with Michael Russo. Thanks, everybody, as always, for joining in. My guest today, very special guest, Kyle Brodziak, as we continue our series looking back at the glory days of the 20-year history of the Minnesota Wild. Kyle Brodziak was actually the first player trade in the Chuck Fletcher regime way back in 2009. The Wild acquired him at the entry draft, and Kyle came to the Minnesota Wild from the Edmonton Oilers, his hometown Oilers, and became one of the great checking centers in Wild history. Great faceoff man, great penalty killer, stand-up guy in the locker room. And this week, we have a fun conversation where we talk about the Wild. We talk about how he was the guy that knew that Nino Niederreiter's shot went under the crossbar, hit the camera, and came out in Game 7 against the Colorado Avalanche to advance to the next round against the Chicago Blackhawks. So we talk all about that, but most importantly, we're talking about something that Kyle's going to be doing this week, and that's playing in the world's longest game, 252 hours of hockey to raise money for cancer up in Edmonton. It's to honor his late father, Dale. Dale died at age 42 of cancer when Kyle was just 14. Never got to see Kyle's successful, almost 1,000-game hockey career. So we talk about that and why he's playing in the game, and we talk about his future. This has been a really crazy week for the Minnesota Wild since we did the Curtis Foster podcast last week. I mean, just think of everything that's happened this week. First of all, we find out that Marco Rossi has COVID-19 complications. I think it's something that we've pretty much known for the last month, but the Wild acknowledged that for the first time, and he returned to Austria. The goal now is to get him healthy. I did a big story in The Athletic yesterday where I talked to his agent, Serge Paille, about what went on with Marco and how absolutely unexpected this came after World Junior Championships when he did his cardiac screening and blood work with the Wild doctors and failed his physical, and it showed that he had long-term effects of COVID-19. They've gotten encouraging news in the last 3 weeks, but he went back to Austria, and his job now is to do nothing. Don't exercise, don't skate, just get healthy, and in 6 weeks, he'll either come back to Minnesota to reassess or do virtual doctor's appointments from over there so he doesn't have to fly back. But the goal is to get him ready for training camp next year. But then also, since the Curtis Foster podcast, Kevin Fiala boards Matthew Roy in the corner against the Los Angeles Kings, earns a three-game suspension. He'll serve that final game tonight against the Colorado Avalanche and come back Thursday night. Man, the Wild need him, because then they lose Marcus Johansson to an injury, Matt Dumba to a serious-looking lower body injury, and now Marcus Foligno has tested positive for the coronavirus, and the hope now is that they've maintained that they what's the word I'm looking for? Constrain? Probably not. But keep this to just Marcus and nobody else, which just seems so hard when you look around the league and you see these outbreaks in teams, whether it's Chicago or Vegas or New Jersey. Tonight, Buffalo and Islanders are postponed. So the hope is that just Marcus Foligno is contained, and then nobody else gets it. But, man, you know what? The Wild come out in Game 2 against the Avalanche after getting steamrolled the first game, and you just think with a mishmash lineup and Jerry Mayhew in the lineup and Luke Johnson and Kyle Rowe that they're just going to get smoked in Game 2. And what do the Wild do? They get Cam Talbot back in the lineup, a couple goals from Victor Rask, a game-winning goal from Jonas Brodin, another great game from Jordan Greenway, and great contributions from those three taxi squad guys. And they pull out a gritty win in Game 2 of this four-game set against the Avalanche. Now they go to Denver. They play these two games here, and then they come back for a four-game homestand against the Arizona Coyotes and the St. Louis Blues. But without further ado, one of my favorite players that I've covered in the 20-year history of the Minnesota Wild, Kyle Brodziak. And as promised, Kyle Brodziak, one of the best checking centers in Wild history, the first player trade in the Chuck Fletcher era, almost half his 917 career regular season games with the Wild, 129 goals, 296 points, great faceoff man, great penalty killer, and honestly, Kyle, one of the most stand-up guys in the Wild locker room, win or loss, usually after loss, we used to go up to you because you were just so honest, and so I always felt bad for you because you just almost knew that after every loss, so we were going to ask for Kyle Brodziak because you were such a great quote. But most importantly, your claim to fame, you were once the Wild's leading goal scorer at Christmas time. Do you remember that?
I think I do remember that, yeah.
You scored your 10th goal. I still remember it. You scored your 10th goal in Arizona at Christmas time, and that was the year that like the Wild had just acquired like Danny Heatley and Setoguchi and all these shooters, and you were, I think, on a line with Heater. And there, Kyle Brodziak, leading goal scorer at Christmas, just like we all like expected.
Yeah. No, I do remember that year. Yeah, I've got I think that was definitely my best offensive production season that I had ever had. So it was a lot of fun that year.
It came at a good time, a contract year. You signed a four-year extension, right?
Three-year extension. Yeah. So it was, it was good timing for sure.
In 2009, I mean, and by the way, we're going to talk to Kyle about, as I mentioned earlier, the world's longest game and why he's doing it, which is really, really special. And today's a big day. Kyle's actually going to move into his trailer today for the game that starts in 2 days, 252 hours. We're going to talk a lot about that. But Kyle, 2009, obviously Chuck Fletcher knew you from actually your time when I believe Wilkes-Barre split a farm team with Edmonton and Pittsburgh. So he knew you from there, right?
Yeah. The first couple of years, actually my first year pro, I played for the Edmonton Roadrunners in the AHL. Then the next 2 years, Edmonton didn't have their own farm team, so all the guys got loaned out to different teams. My second year, I ended up playing with Dallas's farm system, the Iowa Stars. And then my third year, I was in Wilkes-Barre with Pittsburgh's farm team. So I got to know Chuck Fletcher a little bit that year. Todd Richards was my head coach there, and obviously he was the coach hired, the first coach hired under Chuck Fletcher. So it was I came into a good situation where they both knew me and they both liked my game. So it was a good situation to come into for sure.
Obviously, you're from Edmonton. You're playing your first 4 years. You're actually from St. Paul, Alberta, by the way, I should say that. But your first 4 years in the NHL, you're playing for your hometown team. And then all of a sudden in the middle of June, you get the call that you're traded to the Wild. I mean, those have to be like, I've got to think sometimes in the middle of a hockey season, you're always on pins and needles thinking I could be traded at any time. But when you're not thinking hockey in the middle of June, that's got to be the most blindsided trade that you ever get, right?
It was a little. To be honest, we were trying to negotiate a contract with Edmonton for a couple weeks before that, and just didn't seem to be getting anywhere. And my agent had he kind of mentioned He just said he felt like something was up. We weren't really getting anywhere when we thought we should have been. It definitely was. You know, you never expect to get traded or expect it to happen, but when it did happen, it was kind of almost like I guess you could kind of see it coming now. Now that it actually happened, but never easy. But like I said, it was good to go into a situation where I had some familiarity at least with Todd and with Chuck. So it was. Something that I was definitely looking forward to. I didn't really know any of the guys on the team. I hadn't really crossed paths with any of the guys. I think the only guy that I would have maybe crossed paths with was Josh Harding. Mm-hmm. And when we played against each other for a few years in the WHL. But that was pretty much the only guy that I might have had any ties with at all.
I still remember your agent, by the way, Alain Waugh, right?
Yep.
He was always good, especially, always forthcoming whenever it was contract negotiations and things like that with you. Let me ask you, I mentioned being a stand-up guy, and Wild fans have grown accustomed to me always joking that whenever the Wild acquired, like they acquired Ian Cole last week, and, I throw all his stats on Twitter and I say, but most importantly, a great quote. Wild fans are always accustomed to me being very selfish when it comes to, what I think about the value of players. But genuinely, as I'm sure Wild fans are already hearing on this, you were a great, great quote and a very, very stand-up guy. And, you really reminded me of an old school hockey player. Like, I remember my early years covering the NHL, you would walk into a locker room and you would see 10 guys sitting at their stalls, slowly untaping their gear and things like that. And writers would have sort of the run of the mill. And a lot of times you walk into a locker room now and you're lucky if one person's still sitting in their stall. And we're talking about 5-minute cool off periods. But you always, win or loss, you were always just, I still remember it. I mean, you sat right in the middle of the locker room and you, a lot of times we'd walk in and you'd just be staring down at the carpet. One, why were you so slow taking off your gear? And two, it just seemed like you were always more than willing to talk to us.
Well, let's clear the air about something first. I never enjoyed talking after a loss. That was, I know I always got,
selected.
I always got selected. I kind of expected it. I felt like I could, I could maybe keep my head even after a loss, where, some guys just detested talking after a loss or they would take off. But my generation, I grew up, at the end of a hockey game, sometimes I'd sit there for 45 minutes or an hour in my gear. You don't really want to move. You're tired. You kind of just want to sit in your gear and, get it, take it off as slow as you can and kind of hang out. But obviously times have changed and, usually there's, 5 minute, the players have 5 minutes before the media get in there. So, a lot of guys are kind of in a hurry to get out of there, but I still had, a tough time letting go of that where I'll deal with talking to the media, but I just want to sit in my gear and just hang out for a few minutes and unwind a little bit.
You could always tell, the player that doesn't want to talk to us, he'll almost animatedly look at the board to show us that you're the number is not on the board, when we go up to you. And but you never were like that. You always, and we're like that with Foligno now. Foligno's kind of like our lost quote in the Wild locker room. And it was funny, a couple years ago, Ryan Suter, we started to realize that almost after every loss, we would get Ryan Suter because he's so honest after a loss and almost politically incorrect. And then one day he had this great game in New Jersey. They won the game and we asked for Suter after the game and he was again. And we're like, well, we figured we'd get you after a win for once.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. Some guys some guys are, I guess, more capable of doing it after a loss, and some guys are better doing it after, after good things are happening. So, yeah, it is what it is, I guess. I never really loved doing it after a loss, but at the end of the day, it's still part of your job, and everybody's got to contribute to that for sure.
Right. When we talk about your style, Kyle, I mean, you were a gritty player. I mean, penalty killer, shot blocker, Great face-off, man. I mean, does there come a point in every hockey player's career that you've just got – were you always like that in junior, or did you – is there that point where you've all got to say, you know what, if I'm going to make it, I've got to adopt to this type of style?
I think it started in junior. My coach in junior, Curtis Hunt, when I was young, 16, 17 years old, my first couple of years in junior, he really stressed the defensive side for me, learning how to play the defensive side of the game, becoming a checking centerman. And his reasoning was always, if I was ever wanted to make the NHL, that's the type of game that I would have to play. So, I took that to heart and you know, made it a point of pride to play hard defensively and be hard to play against. So, I would say that my style throughout my NHL career definitely evolved and it definitely changed. My first couple of years in the league, I played a little more offensively, I guess, than the second half of my career probably. I would say pretty much when Josi came in, I think it was the second year that he was there is kind of when my role started to change. It became more of a defensive center where, before I was probably still trying to play a little more offense. And then that year, that second year with Josi there, we had a lot of young guys coming in. Granlin was coming in. Charlie Coyle, Zucker came in. So my role changed, and going into the year, I knew it was gonna change a little bit, and went to a little more defensive role, and pretty much stayed with it, the rest of my career after that.
You were really tight with Mikko Koivu. You came to his 1,000th game celebration. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to play that game, which meant that he got to at least spend time with you. In the box. Before we talk about Koivu, I mean, the one thing I do remember, Kyle, about you being there is just it was painful watching you walk. I mean, and that's how your career ended. You're only 36 years old, and you were still a functional, very good player at the end there. But you're back. I mean, how are you now, and how tough was it to sort of really have your career end before it probably should have?
With that, I would say that, well, right now, my back is doing pretty good right now. I went through a phase last winter, pretty much right during the Koivu celebration. I had heard, because that was in middle of December.
Yep.
So I remember it was at the start of November, I kind of hurt my back again, just tweaked something, For some reason, it lasted a lot longer. I kind of dealt with it all of November, all of December. And just thinking, I've gone through this process before. I should be able to figure out how to get myself better again, because I've done it a few times and pretty much remembered the regimen that I was going through with the trainers to get myself back healthy. But for some reason, last winter, I couldn't... I was really struggling with it, so I finally went at the start of January to I finally went to see somebody that the Oilers had hooked me up with, and pretty much took me till sometime in February to get it better. So it was a couple months of struggling with it, and it was a bit of an eye opener that this is something that I'm going to be having to deal with probably the rest of my life, and. If I want to make it easier on myself, then I'm going to have to put in the work, put in the daily work to keep my core strong and keep my body strong. So I've done a fairly decent job of that for the last year, and I've got myself at least to a point where I can get out of bed and put socks on comfortably without that being too much of a struggle. So. I'm probably exaggerating a little. I do feel pretty good right now. So, Definitely happy to be keeping that up.
Well, I remember Zach Parise was telling me about his back struggles. I mean, you know, the final straw for him is that his wife would have to take him to dinner and he would lie in the back of their SUV because he couldn't sit normally in a car. He used to eat standing up. I mean, it's just got to be just excruciating what you guys put your bodies through.
Yeah, I went through a few of those phases as well last year, like when I was staying at the November, December, where I'd go to a restaurant with my wife, and I'd end up having to go back out into the car. I couldn't sit down in the restaurant for very long. So it was a few tough stretches, but thankfully we're surrounded by some of the best trainers in the world who know how to take care of us and know how to get us back to health pretty quickly.
What is it about Mikko that made you two connect so well that you would actually, you know, fly here in the middle of your pain and take part in that celebration?
I don't know what it was exactly, but we definitely hit it off right away. I think we played, just playing against each other for a few years when I was in Edmonton, and we kind of battled, being centermen, we battled a little bit with each other. And I think once we became teammates, that kind of carried over where, we would, during practice, we'd battle each other pretty good. And I know some of the guys would get a kick out of it sometimes watching us go at each other. But, he was a guy that, I loved his demeanor. I loved his leadership skills, how he just genuinely had a passion for the game of hockey and for the team to do well and to do the right things. Just a lot of qualities that I really looked up to him. So he was a great friend and a great teammate, and definitely one of my favorites ever.
I'm just looking at your stats here, Kyle. I forgot this, that your first 7 years in the NHL, you missed six games.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, stability is just crazy. Your time with the Minnesota Wild, how about this? 82 games your first year, 80 games your second year, 82 games your third year, 48 games your which was the lockout shortened full season. 81 your last year here, or your second to last year here. So, I mean, it's crazy the stability that you had. Sorry, I just had to point that out.
No, that's right. Yeah, it's, I always looked at it as, staying healthy is, I would say, partly a skill and partly luck as well. There's some guys who just seem to have terrible luck, and, there's some guys who get lucky. So I do think it's, there's a lot of luck involved, but there's probably a level of skill involved with it too, I guess. I don't know.
Right. Again, I want to talk to you about the world's longest game. I also want to talk to you about one of the most emblematic moments in Wild history, which is 2014 Game 7. But let me just, before we talk about the world's longest game, let me ask you about Jared Spurgeon being named captain, the heir apparent to Mikko Koivu, somebody you played with for six years. You played with him.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. You know what's amazing? I mean, you were on that 2010 team where he made his NHL debut, and I talk about it all the time. None of us had even heard of him when he was called up in Calgary on his 21st birthday, and here he is 10 years later, the captain of the team. Tell us a little bit about the maturation and development of Jared Spurgeon.
Oh, I think it's an amazing story. I don't know how much maturation there is. I mean, when he was 20 years old, he was probably more mature than the rest of the guys in the room already at that point anyway. But as you know, he's just an awesome guy. Everything he stands for, everything he does, it's the right way. He does everything the right way. He on the ice, off the ice, just the way he lives his life is something that everybody should be looking up to and trying to emulate. He's one of those guys that he's had to overcome a lot of things, and he's done it the right way, and he should be very, very proud of it. And I couldn't be happier for him, and I couldn't be happier that the organization went out. It probably wasn't an easy decision to make him captain. There's probably some other, more popular choices, but In my mind, it was the right choice, and I couldn't be happier for her.
Starting Thursday to February 14th, this is just crazy to me. 40 players, 252 hours of hockey to raise money to fight cancer. They're playing in the world's longest game up in Edmonton at the Sakers Acres try to break the Guinness World Record for longest game. If you want to check this out, by the way, go to worldslongestgame.ca/donate to donate money as well. They're trying to raise a bunch of money. They've already, over the years that they've done this, raised more than $5 million. First of all, how does this work? I mean, you're not obviously out there for 252 hours. They give you a trailer, right, that you could live in?
I think pretty much everyone is kind of expected to bring their own trailer.
Okay.
My mom and stepdad had a fifth wheel that I will be borrowing. I went out there the other day, and there's got to be almost 40 trailers out there that are all just lined up, just in an open field. So, it's going to be pretty crazy. I know that our shifts, they kind of go, so there, it's two teams of 20, divided into two lines of 10, I guess each team is divided into two lines of 10. So, it sounds like our shifts go, 4 hours on, 4 hours off, four on, four off, and then you do an 8 hour shift on, and then you get an 8 hour shift off, and then you kind of repeat that cycle. So you're pretty much on the ice, it averages out to 12 hours a day for the 12 or so days that we're doing this. So it's going to be a lot of hockey.
Wow. And I mean, you're back on hold up.
Oh, I hope so. I'm going to push it as hard as I can. I know that there's going to be some stuff I'm going to have to do in between, in between sessions to kind of take care of it, just to make sure that, I'm staying on top of it. But, I really hope so. I'm really counting on it to hold up. So we'll see as it goes.
You I've talked to you about your father, Dale, before, and as I mentioned at the top of the show, before you were on, Kyle, is that your dad passed away of cancer at age 42 when you were just 14. 23 years later, you're playing in this event. How did that tragic event really transform your life?
It transformed my life big time. It's probably hard to pin down exactly, the ways that it did that, but, I guess probably the most important years of my life, I didn't really have my most important role model. So, I think, there was some, probably some difficulty finding my direction that I wanted to go into or with my life. And, it probably took me a few years longer than I would have liked to kind of, land on my feet again and figure out, who I was and things like that. But, saying that, there's a lot of people that go through it. I'm fortunate to have, to be surrounded in my life by a lot of people that, that helped me, get through that difficult time. And, it definitely wasn't easy, and it still isn't easy today, but, it was very unfortunate.
And I know your mom was somebody that was just a hero in your life, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. She was unbelievable. She did anything for me. Having to raise three kids on her own and still finding a way, still managed to, for all of us to she gave us whatever we needed, whatever we wanted. And, it probably could have been easy for her to do away with a lot of those things for us. But, after my dad passed, she let me continue playing hockey and drove me wherever I needed to go to play hockey, and put up with me when I was a terrible teenage, a teenage boy at home when, going through whatever we were going through as kids as well. And, she was a rock for us. So grateful to this day that, she led us, through the hardest times of our life. So.
Merrily, right?
Marielle.
Yeah. Marielle. She was on the mother son trip?
You know what? I never was part of a team that did a mother's trip.
Okay,
it must have been
the year before you got here. Yes, it would have been Doug Reisbrow's last year, actually. So
okay,
because I do remember meeting her one day. I cannot remember where. It was at a Wild game. It might have been in Edmonton. Maybe it was the game where didn't you score a shootout goal in Edmonton?
Yeah.
That was the great one, wasn't it? You were like round like eight or something, right? It was like late.
I think it might have been earlier that game. Okay. I want to say six, maybe six or seven. I think I had a pretty good game. That's the only reason why I was that high in the lineup on a shootout. Normally I'd be down around at least 10 or even lower than that. But I had a good game. I think I scored one or two goals already in the game, or maybe had a goal and assist. So. I think Yosi must felt confident with me, but I think it was around six or seven, and I was fortunate to put one in.
I feel like Nick Schultz had a great quote after the game where he said he started to get nervous when you got picked.
Yeah, yeah, Schultzy, of course, would say something like that. That's good.
Oh man, that's funny.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Back here with Kyle Brodziak. Thanks, everybody, as always, for listening to Straight from the Source. And again, you can always subscribe to The Athletic at theathletic.com/straightfromthesource. Great deals going on right now. This one is $3.99 a month. Also, great podcasts across The Athletic. 2022 Winter Olympics are 1 year out, and former NHL coach Ken Hitchcock joined Scott Burnside and Pierre LeBrun on Two-Man Advantage this week at The Athletic Hockey Show Wednesday. And Tom Dundon, the owner of the Carolina Hurricanes, spends 60 minutes with Craig Custance on the full 60. Kyle, you are at the end of, we're 20 years into the Wild history, and there's three probably iconic moments that I can think about. One is Andrew Brunette's goal. Two would be probably Mary Gabrick's five-goal game. But the third one is Nino Niederreiter's game-winning goal in Colorado, game seven. You get the primary assist. And you were the one that knew that puck went in the net. I mean, the sound of you jumping up, screaming, is still something that I think will go down in Wild lore as being something, 50, 100 years from now, we're going to see Kyle Brodziak jumping up and down with Nino in the corner. Tell us about that whole game. It was just such a, one of those gnaw off your fingernails games. You guys were down four times in that game.
Yeah, I would still put it as the craziest game I've ever been a part of in my entire life. And I remember, even halfway through the third period, I remember sitting on the bench thinking, this game is crazy already. Like, it's just back and forth and back and forth, and you never really know what was going to happen. And it just, yeah, it, you know, they would score to take a lead, and we'd come back and tie it, and then they'd take a lead again. And then that goal that Spurge scored, I think there was, 4 minutes left?
No, it was less than that. He scored, I'll tell you exactly, scored with 2 minutes and 27 seconds left.
Really?
So overtime, yeah.
2:27, okay. Yep. But just the way that play unfolded, like, it just kind of felt like this something weird is happening right now. Like, it was meant to be, where, you know, we just kept finding a way to come back. And you know, I felt like during the whole series, we just, it was like we were never getting any of the bounces. Like, we were
true.
We were playing well, but it just seemed like everything was going against us. And for that game to finally have things go our way, it just it was just amazing. It was an amazing game to be a part of, and I'll never ever forget it.
Yeah, that series, the home team had won the previous six games. There were two goals that Colorado scored that were game-changing goals that they, if the offsides challenge appeared at that point, would have been overturned. That was a series where Nathan MacKinnon was absolutely unbelievable at home, but couldn't function in Minnesota, in large part because of people like Kyle Brodziak and Eric Halla, who they really threw him on at home. But that Game 7 line of you, Nina Ryder, and Danny Heatley, for the analytics people out there, I bet you if you look that up, that game you spent the entire night with the puck. You had three assists in that game. You made some unbelievable plays coming over the goal line for one of Niederreiter's first tying goals, and then obviously the game-winning goal as well.
Yeah, that series was a bit of a roller coaster for me. I know early on, I think it was maybe game one, I just had a real tough time. I made one terrible giveaway. I just vaguely remember a couple of just defensive mistakes that I was making. Having trouble. I had trouble shutting down that line. And then I think it was health. It was a healthy scratch in game three.
Mm-hmm. You and Heatley, and if I remember. I think Heatley was scratching that series as well.
Oh, he was.
Yeah.
I can't remember that, but yeah. So I remember getting scratched and. You know what, Halla came in and did an unbelievable job against MacKinnon, because that is not an easy task. But you know, the way he shut MacKinnon down, that was, you know, a huge reason why we were able to come back in the series and eventually win. But yeah, just the roller coaster series for me. Yeah, I went through a lot of down points and early on, and then later on as the series progressed, I thought I started playing better and better. And game seven, yeah, it was just one of those. Like I said, it almost felt like it was meant to be, where every time we stepped on the ice, we were finding a way to do something positive and score a goal to tie the game back up, It just was one of those crazy games that, it just felt like, I don't even know the right word for it. After dealing with a lot of negative stuff that didn't really feel like it was deserved all the time, it was almost like a little vindication at the end of the game where, the hockey gods just felt like they said everything straight after that.
I did an oral history on Game 7 2014, which you were kind enough to be a part of last March, which just seems like a month ago, but really 10 months ago. It's crazy. By the way, if you're listening to this podcast and never read that oral history, it's really entertaining, and I think Wild fans would absolutely love it. So just tweet me, and I'll send out the link. But the one thing that you said in there that, if I remember correctly, was hilarious was that, you were the one that knew that puck went in. It went in and out. Even the broadcasters, some of them weren't positive, and they were just sort of going off your reaction, that you were jumping up and down, yelling and everything. But you actually said that at one point you were actually like worried, like, what if I'm wrong here? This is going to be one embarrassing, humiliating thing if all of a sudden we play on and you cause the entire Wild bench to filter onto the ice.
Yeah, I you know what, like it's crazy because you there's always a certain sound. It's not like I visually saw the puck go in because you watch the replay, it was in and out so fast that you know, it's more the sound that it makes when it hits the back, like the inside bar. And that's when that's what made me start jumping right away. It's just like my immediate reaction was, well, that's in for sure. And then you see heaters scrambling around to try to put it in. And so I'm thinking, holy, maybe it didn't go in. There's other guys that are still playing here that obviously aren't sure that it went in. There's a flash of this could be bad if it turns out that it didn't go in. But yeah, it was and then after that, obviously, you know, everybody starts celebrating, and then you get the word that it was in for sure. And but yeah, it was just kind of a surreal a moment where you're almost positive it's in, but also, you know, there's that shade of doubt that it could look really ugly if it turns out that it didn't go in. So thankfully it did count.
You know, the other major part of that game was that, you know, Kemper gets hurt with probably 7 minutes left and comes out, and in comes an ice cold Brizgalov, who wasn't great earlier in the series. And as nutty and back and forth as that game was, Kyle, from the moment that Brizgalov came in to the moment you won the game, you guys gave up one shot. So it's almost like, you know, there came a point in that game where you became this stingy team that said, you know what, we've got to protect this cold goalie here and go out and win this game.
Yeah. I that's part of it I don't even remember. Like, there's a lot, you know, probably a lot of parts of the game that, you know, important parts that happened that I can't even remember. And that's how crazy that game was. So many moving parts and so many different things that happened during the game to, you know, for the result to turn out the way it did. And, I don't remember. I vaguely remember, Kemper leaving and Bruce coming in, but, giving up one shot after that, how far into overtime was Nino's goal?
It was 5:02.
5:02, so right around, so about 12, 13 minutes of hockey, you're giving up one shot.
To that juggernaut at home.
It's crazy. Yeah, that's pretty impressive, yeah.
Yep. Last question on the game. By the way, the one thing I remember is game one in Chicago, where all of a sudden we're on the ice and Bob Mason is honestly skating up to your goalies trying to figure out who's going to start that night because, you know, Brizgalov, Kemper, John Curry was out there, Backy, all that type of thing. Last question on game seven is, what was it like in the post-game locker room in terms of celebration? Because you didn't have time to breathe. You guys had to get on a flight that night, and it was either going back to Minnesota or going to Chicago, and you wound up, packing up, heading to the long trip to the airport and getting ready for game one against the Blackhawks 2 nights later.
Yeah, the celebration was short. Like you said, I think, you know, you come in the dressing room and there's about 5 minutes of just elation where guys are, you know, I think just cheering, congratulating each other, doing whatever. And then all of a sudden you flip the switch. It's like, okay, we got to pack up and get out of here because even on if we get out of here as fast as we can, we're still only going to get to Chicago at around 4 a.m. And basically a day and a half later, we're playing a game one. So it was a quick turnaround. It was a quick turnaround. Just, like I said, 5-10 minutes of celebrating, and then it's move on. And, I'm sure that, you know, I do remember the guys are still on the bus ride to the airport because that's still a long bus ride. Yep. from downtown Colorado to the airport. Guys were definitely having a few beers on the bus and kind of winding down a little that way. But it wasn't too crazy of a, you know, after that, it's pretty much, try to calm yourself down and turn your focus to what's going on. Cause, it's all of a sudden you start preparing for Chicago right away. Even that night, you turn the page and you put your focus on Chicago, and, You start mentally thinking about it even that night. So, it was a quick turnaround, but it would have been nice to be able to celebrate that game a little more. But that's part of it.
Kyle, I know you got to move into your trailer today. If you don't mind, let me just throw you three or four Twitter questions. It's okay, from Wild Diehards.
Sure.
Let's see. Fetty Dean wants to know, what is Kyle's favorite memory as a Wild at the X? And could you imagine what it's like playing in an empty arena?
Oh, at the X. I had lots of good memories at the X. Favorite. I'm trying to think of a certain game, big win that we had. It seemed like all the big wins we had were on the road.
Yeah.
I remember the first time we clinched the playoff spot with the year before was also in Colorado, I think. Yep. The last game of the year.
Yeah, that was, remember you came home to play Edmonton. Backstrom was Backstrom and his career was like 16-0 or something against the Oilers. It was crazy at home. And next thing you guys are like down 4-0 after one, and in came Harding. You had a win. It was the lockout shortened season. You had a win in Colorado in the final game to advance.
Yeah. So that was also on the road. I'm trying to think, was there any huge wins that we had? Well, I just love the building and the atmosphere. I don't know if I have a specific moment. I just love playing in that rink. When come playoff time, that building is loud and it is fun to play in. I don't know. Specific memory. I'll try to think of one in the next few minutes.
Okay.
I can't think. What was the second part of the question?
Just playing in an empty arena. That's got to be odd.
It's got to be odd. Yeah, it's probably taken guys quite a while to get used to. I'm sure they're not even used to it yet. Where I can't even imagine playing a real NHL game where you could basically hear a pin drop in the arena. That would be kind of an eerie feeling where you could probably hear everything that's going on either bench, which usually don't have access to listen to what's going on the opponent's bench. But I'm sure guys can hear each other pretty clear out there. A lot of the talk that goes on the bench. So that's probably, taking guys a little bit to get used to. I don't know. I don't know if I could do it. It would be really weird. That's for sure.
Hogama Dog Hockey, I'm probably mispronouncing that. What's the difference about playing in Minnesota compared to Edmonton and St. Louis? I got to think, one difference is not having Dreisaitl and McDavid to play with. That's probably the biggest difference, right?
I wasn't going to go that angle, but that type of high end talent is totally different. It's incredible to have to be a part of. To be able to watch those guys every day, the difference. Every three spots all had different things to like about them. Minnesota. My wife and I still talk about how much we love the city. We still have connections there. Still have friends that we keep in touch with there. Just 6 years, and we loved every minute of it from. The first three years we lived downtown Minneapolis, which was amazing. And then the last 3 years we had bought a house in Edina and got to experience that and loved living there as well. The way the organization treats you, the rink, being downtown St. Paul, that whole area is just a lot of great memories. And we don't really have any negative things to say about our whole time in Minnesota. We still talk very highly of it. I guess, the difference maybe St. Louis was St. Louis still has a big hockey following, obviously not to the extent as it is in Minnesota. Minnesota and Edmonton are very similar. The weather is close. It's probably, maybe Minnesota might be a little bit more mild of a winter, but not much. It's very similar. People are friendly. When we got traded to Minnesota, for people that had been there, they always said it's pretty much as close to a Canadian city as you're going to get. And we found that to be very true, where the people are, just as friendly as they are here in Canada. And, they treated us as well as we could have hoped.
Russo Slacks wants to know which was more painful, laying down for blocking a PK slap shot or having to talk to Russo after every game?
having to talk to you after losses for sure. No, I'm just kidding. More painful for sure would be the blocking shots on the PK. There's one in particular I'll never forget. It was from Shea Weber when he was in Nashville. There was one that got me on the inside of my thigh, and I had a bruise that pretty much took up about half my thigh.
That.
So yeah. So that's one block shot I'll never forget. And thankfully I only had one from him. So
lastly, Kyle, what's next? You have 252 hours of hockey coming up. The Wild, by the way, have a lot of holes at center. So if you feel good after that 252 hours, yeah. I bet you Billy Guerin would probably sign you and put you at first line center at this point. What's next for you?
I'm not sure yet. When hockey came to an end, I decided that I wanted to take some time and spend as much time at home as I can. I have three young boys right now, and I'm fortunate enough to be able to spend the time with them. So I'm going to take advantage of that right now. Eventually I'm going to have to get into, to something else. But I'm not quite sure what that's going to be yet. I've dabbled around with the thought of maybe getting into coaching one day. But I'm not sure. I don't know. I guess that a lot of that would vary on what kind of opportunities were out there. I'm not sure. I'm just enjoying my time at home right now. I want to, just take advantage of being able to be at home with my boys at this age. I started coaching two of my boys at minor hockey this year until, obviously, with COVID and the pandemic, the hockey season got shut down. But I think that's, the next little while, all my focus is just going to be on, being a stay-at-home dad and raising my kids here. And eventually, hopefully, something will come up that intrigues me, and I'll move on with that.
Well, I look forward to really hearing about this, about the world's longest game. I know it's actually the second time you've played 40 players, 252 hours of hockey starting Thursday until February 14th, trying to break the Guinness World Record for longest game of hockey. It's absolutely crazy. And again, if you want to donate and you're listening, you can go to worldslongestgame.ca/donate. And not only that, can you donate to the game itself, you could donate in honor of a player. So if you click on donate to a player, you could actually scroll down to Kyle Brodziak and donate in honor of him. You can even donate in honor of a volunteer. I know they've got hundreds of volunteers there. And again, this is for a future to free this world of cancer. So Kyle, really have fun this week. I hope everything just turns out and you have a blast.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I think it's going to be... I think it's going to be the time of my life. I know that guys say that there's a lot of challenges that go along with it. A lot of it depends on weather, and it looks like it's going to be there's going to be some moments where we're playing it through the middle of the night where it probably touches down to minus 30. But I think for the most part, it looks like it's going to be it's not going to be too bad. So there's going to be challenges, but everybody says it's the time of your life, and It's worth every bit of it.
That's awesome, and it's such a great cause. Well, hey, thanks, Kyle. And if you're listening to this podcast, check out our comments section for each podcast episode of The Athletic app, and rate and subscribe to Straight from the Source on Apple. If you aren't already a subscriber to The Athletic, go to theathletic.com/straightfromthesource and receive a subscription for just $3.99 per month. Thanks a lot, Kyle. Have a blast this week.
All right, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.